relating the story Luke already knew. We stole the sun crusher out from under her nose, and we wasted our opportunity. We had a weapon that could have struck a decisive blow against the world still loyal to the Empire. But what did we do with it? We threw the sun crusher into a gas planet where it won't help us at all. Calm, Luke said. He gestured for Kip to sit back down, but Kip placed his hands flat on the veined stone table, leaning over to glare at Luke. The Imperial threat is not going to go away, he said. If we pool our Jedi powers, we can resurrect the Sun Crusher, tear it out from the core of Yavin. We can take it and go hunt the Imperials. What would be a clearer mission for us? Why are we just hiding here in this backwater moon? He paused, fuming. When the other students looked at him, Kip glared back at them. Are you all stupid? He shouted. We don't have the luxury to fine-tune our levitating abilities, or balance rocks, or sense rodents out in the jungle. What good does that do? If we aren't going to use our powers to help the New Republic, then why bother? Luke looked at Mara Jade, who seemed greatly interested in this discussion. He refocused his attention on Kip. The young man's meal was practically untouched. Because that isn't the Jedi way, Luke said. You've studied the code. You know how we must approach a difficult situation. The Jedi do not set out to destroy recklessly. Kip turned his back on Luke and stormed toward the door of the dining chamber. At the arched stone entrance to the room, Kip whirled and said, If we don't use our power, then we may as well not have it. We're betraying the Force with our cowardice. He gritted his teeth, and his words came out much more quietly. I'm not certain what else I can learn here, Master Skywalker. With that, he vanished into the corridor. Kip felt his skin tingling with barely contained power, as if his blood had begun to fizz inside of him. He moved down the temple corridors like a projectile, and when he reached the heavy door to his quarters, he used the Force to fling it open and slam it against the far wall with enough strength to flake a long splinter of stone from the blocks. How could he ever have admired Master Skywalker? What did Han Solo see in him as a friend? The Jedi teacher was blind to reality, ignoring problems, covering his eyes with his Jedi cloak, and refusing to use his own powers for the good of the New Republic. The Empire remained a threat, as Dala's attacks on Calamari and Dantooine demonstrated. If Skywalker refused to use his powers to wipe out the enemy, then perhaps his convictions were not strong enough. But Kip's were. He could stay at the Jedi Academy no longer. He yanked at the collar of his robe to tear it off. From his stash of personal belongings, Kip pulled out a satchel that contained the flowing black cape that Han had given him as a goodbye gift. During his training at the Praxium, he had been content to wear the rough old robe Master Skywalker provided, but now he wanted nothing more to do with it. Exar Kun had shown him how to unleash great powers. Kip did not trust the Sith Lord, but he could not deny the truth of what the Shadow Man taught. Kip could see the power actually working. For now, he had to get away to ponder and sort through the conflicting thoughts in his mind. He opened up the satchel to look at the black cape. A pair of small, lightning-fast rodents dashed out from their nest in his garment and vanished like hot liquid through a chink in the stone wall. Alarmed, Kip lost control of his anger for an instant and let fly a searing blast of power that followed the two rodents down their narrow tunnels and incinerated them as they ran. Blackened bones tumbled forward with the momentum, then slumped to dust in the stone tunnel. Paying no more heed to the distraction, Kip pulled out the flowing cape, holding it in front of him. Its embedded reflective thread sparkled as if with hidden power. Kip wrapped it around himself and gathered a few of his other possessions. He had to go far away. He had to think. He had to be strong. Later that evening, when R2 sounded all the alarms, Luke awoke instantly. He sprinted down the corridors to the outside landing area. Mara Jade ran beside him, already alert, as if she had a good idea of what might be happening. Luke's eyes adjusted rapidly to the star-strewn sky, which was fuzzy and pale in the south with skyshine from the gas giant Yavin. Mara and Luke stood outside the half-open hangar doors as they watched her Z-95 headhunter rise from the landing grid with all its running lights darkened. "He's stealing my ship!" Mara Jade shouted. The headhunter's sublight engines kicked in, burning white-hot behind the craft as it shot into the sky. Luke shook his head in disbelief, and realized that he had unconsciously extended one hand, beckoning for Kip Duran to return. The small ship became a white streak of light that grew smaller and smaller as it reached orbit, then set out among the stars. Luke felt a devastating emptiness, knowing that he had lost another of his Jedi students forever. 24. Every flagstone gleamed. Every imperial column had been scrubbed white. Every colorful banner representing the Empire's most loyal worlds hung absolutely straight, displayed without a wrinkle. Everything was in order at the main citadel of the Imperial Military Academy on Corrida. Ambassador Fergan nodded, just the way he liked it. 300 crack stormtroopers stood at attention in the echoing hall, motionless in perfect ranks. Their white armor glistened like polished bone. They were identical, intensively trained, precise military machines. These stormtroopers were the best of the best in the academy. Only the top Imperial recruits even began stormtrooper training, and these 300 had excelled in every way. Ambassador Fergan moved toward the podium to address them. The smell of oils and waxes on the synthetic wood seemed potent in the otherwise sterilized air. Fergan drew himself up, trying to look larger than his stocky stature allowed. The white helmets turned in unison to track him with their black goggles. "Imperial troops," he said, "you have been chosen to lead the most important mission since the fall of our beloved Emperor. You have endured hardship and passed many tests during your training. I have chosen you as the elite, the best trainees remaining on Corrida." They did not stir, did not congratulate each other. They remained like ranks of statues, which itself attested to the thoroughness of their training. Since receiving the long-awaited coordinates of the secret planet Anoth, Fergan had plotted this operation with extreme caution. He had studied the personnel data of thousands of his best troops. He had analyzed the records of their training exercises. Mock combat in the harsh ice caps of Corrida, prolonged sieges out in the baked and waterless deserts, jungle survival tours through dense and uncharted rainforests filled with primitive predators, carnivorous plants, and poisonous insects. Fergan had culled the names of these stormtroopers who had shown the most stamina, the most initiative, the greatest success, coupled with the strongest willingness to follow every order. He was proud of his assault force. "We have obtained secret information regarding the location of a certain baby, a child with enormous potential for using the Force." He paused, expecting to hear them groan, but the stormtroopers made no sound. "This child is the son of Leia Organa Solo, the New Republic's Minister of State. If we were to apprehend this child, it would deal an enormous psychological blow to the rebellion. But beyond that, this boy is the grandson of Darth Vader." There, finally, he thought he heard a rustle of superstitious fear or awe. "This child could be extremely valuable to the rebirth of the Empire. A child such as this, raised properly and trained properly, could become a worthy successor to the Emperor Palpatine." Fergan kept talking, faster now as he felt the excitement within him. He was more than just an ambassador. He planned to go along on this assault himself. He would not expose himself to any part of the attack, of course, but he would be there to snatch the young child named Anakin. "Your unit leaders will provide you with specific assignments. This expedition is currently being provisioned. We have secured transports to take you to the secret location of this world." Fergan allowed himself a broad grin with his thick purplish lips. "It is also my pleasure to announce that this assault will mark the first combat use of our new mountain terrain armored transport, on which you have been training these past months. That is all. Hail to the Emperor." The thunderous response of filtered stormtrooper voices came back at him, rocking the hall. "Hail to the Emperor." Fergan slipped behind the hanging purple curtains into a walkway that led down empty glow-lit corridors toward his secure office. Inside his chambers, he closed the blast-proof door and sealed it with a cipher lock. He brushed aside models and plans of the deadly new Mat-At attack vehicles. He felt immensely pleased with himself and eager for the assault to start. Sitting on Corrida during the years of turmoil, Fergan had been upset with all the squabbling Imperial commanders since the Emperor's death. Many of the warlords in the core systems were extremely powerful, yet they spent their time wrestling for dominance among the remnants of the Imperial fleet rather than fighting against their real enemy, the Rebellion. Grand Admiral Thrawn had seemed their greatest hope, but he had been defeated. and a year later, even the resurrected emperor had been defeated. The power vacuum of leadership left the imperial forces with no leadership, no goal, battling only for their own advancement. Even this surprise new threat by renegade Admiral Dalla disturbed Fergan. At least Dalla was putting her star destroyers to an appropriate use, attacking rebel worlds and creating as much havoc as possible. But Dalla had no overriding plan, no strategy that would bring her ultimate success. She was simply a juggernaut, striking target after target for the satisfaction of causing pain. Fergan had discovered to his surprise that Dalla herself had been trained on Kyrita. Digging through old records, he had uncovered many disciplinary actions taken against her, reprimands in her file. Even then, she had been a maverick, performing admirably, but refusing to learn her place, insisting that she deserved promotions instead of others. Fergan had no record of her advancement to admiral, but Moff Tarkin had transferred her to his personal staff after one of his brief inspection tours. Fergan had no other information about Dalla since that time. It angered him that this admiral continued her attacks on the rebellion without even attempting to get in touch with Kyrita. Perhaps Dalla considered herself a vigilante, but the Empire needed its soldiers to fight as parts of an immense whole. The Empire did not need vigilantes. Fergan had tried to contact some of the other battling Imperial commanders to get capital ships for his assault on Anoth. The Emperor and Grand Admiral Thrawn and other depredations had already taken most of the ships available to Kyrita. On the military training planet, Fergan had access to some of the most sophisticated weaponry and soldiers in the entire galaxy. But because of the perpetual squabbles between the Imperial Army and the spacefaring Imperial Navy, he had no place to go with his troops. This left Fergan in a position of being on the most heavily armed, but useless, planet still loyal to the Empire. Fergan absently played with one of the articulated models of the Mat-At fighting vehicle. It would be fascinating to see the marvelous new machine in operation. Even with the death of the Emperor, his loyalty to the Empire and the New Order had never been shaken, not even slightly. Fergan kept doing his best to strike vital blows against the New Republic one way or another. He was pleased to watch indirect reports that gave him evidence of the inexorable progress of Mon Mothma's mysterious illness. She would be dead before long. And as soon as Fergan had the grandson of Darth Vader in his possession, all those still loyal to the Empire would have to listen to him. 25. When Wedge Antilles wasn't looking, Kryzooks stole a glance at the coordinates displayed on his navigation panel. Sitting in the co-pilot's seat of the disguised personal space yacht, Kry used her nimble fingers to tap the coordinates into the navicomputer, requesting a full display. Wedge looked away from the starfield and caught what she was doing. "Hey," he said, then grinned sheepishly as he lowered his gaze. "This was supposed to be a surprise." Kry laughed, a cascade of short musical tones. "I just wanted to know the name of the planet." She frowned as the display came up. "Ithor? Never heard of it." Wedge chuckled and reached over to squeeze her slender shoulder. She felt the warmth of his touch linger for several moments after he removed his hand. "Kry, you've never heard of most places in the galaxy. You've spent your entire life cooped up in Maw installation." "Is Ithor a nice place?" she asked. He sighed. "It's beautiful. A pristine natural world covered with forests and jungles, rivers and waterfalls. We'll be incognito, and you won't have to worry about anybody knowing who you are." Kry looked around at the metal-edged control panels of the space yacht, at the synthetic fabric of the seats that felt so smooth and soft. She smelled the recirculated air. Kry had lived for years inside a completely enclosed environment. She knew nothing about plants and animals and other life forms. She hoped it would be fascinating. "Are you sure we'll be safe?" she asked, swallowing hard. Her greatest nightmare was that some Imperial spy might recapture her and haul her back to the Black Hole Research Lab, where they would tear the weapons knowledge out of her head, no matter how much she resisted. "Yes," Wedge said after a long pause. "Ithor is an isolated paradise. It's a world where many young couples..." He paused, then swallowed as if embarrassed by the word he had just spoken. "Tourists go for vacations. Many people come and go, and the Ithorians welcome everyone. The Empire blockaded this world during the rebellion. causing some damage as a show of force. But after one of the Athorians gave the Empire access to the agricultural and cloning information they wanted, Ithor was basically left alone. Wedge looked out at the starfield where the brilliant sun of the Athorian system gleamed a whitish blue. He increased the thrust from the sublight engines and vectored them toward a bright green planet veined with blue and swathed with white clouds. "Just pretend we're on vacation," Wedge said. "We'll be tourists, and I'll show you what you've been missing. I can't think of a better place to start."
"I really look forward to it."
Kwai smiled warmly at him. Wedge blushed, then seemed to concentrate furiously on the relatively simple task of entering a low orbit. Kwai placed her pale blue fingers against the side viewport as she stared at the lush vistas below. She had never seen such exotic scenery before, so different from the sterile white-walled rooms and Maw installations. Below her, between the treetops of a tropical paradise, broad rivers furled with white rapids as the current flowed over broken rocks. The space yacht soared above broad meadows splattered with brilliant colors, blooming flowers in red and yellow, blue and purple. The sheer vibrancy of the growing things dazzled her eyes. They passed over a chain of oval lakes that glittered and reflected the sunlight like the string of jewels on the necklace Wedge had given her as a gift a few days earlier. Overhead, the sky was a muted lavender.
"Beautiful," she said.
"Told you so," Wedge agreed, giving her a half smile.
"You can trust me."
She looked at him, then blinked her indigo eyes.
"Yes, Wedge, I trust you."
He cleared his throat and turned away quickly, pointing out the front viewport. "The Athorians allow no damage to their environment," he said, as if reading a data summary. "In fact, they consider it sacrilege even to set foot on the ground of their mother jungle."
"Then how do they live?" Kwai asked.
"Look," Wedge said. As they soared above the treetops, Kwai made out a strange shape coming over the horizon, rapidly growing larger as they approached.
"Is that a city?" she said.
"More than just a city," Wedge said. "An entire enclosed environment. The Athorians call it the Tafanda Bay." The enormous disc-shaped construction swelled to fill their front viewport, looking larger and larger and larger, like a fat coin greater in diameter than the entire Maw installation. Though the city appeared to be made of plasteel, it also seemed at least partially alive.